Welcome, 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 welcome to a special broadcast of the Indigo Room. And today is Wednesday, October 17th, 2007. We are really flying here with the days, moving and grooving. I want to say hello to everybody in the room, following my heart. Hi, Dawn. Hi, Matt. Hey, Jim. Welcome to the show. And we have a new listener from South Carolina. Tonight, the reason why we're doing a special episode is because I sort of messed up last week, I think it was, or October 8th, when we had scheduled Neil Swade to join us. So my apologies to everyone. But guess what? I have him tonight. So we're doing a live interactive broadcast of the Indigo Room where we discuss all things spiritual. By that I mean that we believe that we are non-physical beings, spiritual beings having human experiences, and it's all spiritual. Life is supposed to be fun and delicious and good, and we're supposed to be enjoying our experiences, and we create our reality. We are the creators. Our mission statement here at the Indigo Room is it's a spiritual thing, and of course you would understand because you're spiritual too, whether you know it or not. Anyway, our guest tonight is Neil Swade. We have Diana here, too, in the chat room. So please say hello to Diana. Say hi to everybody, Diana.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indigo Room.
Our guest tonight is Neil Swade. And if you haven't had the opportunity to do so, please check out his website, which you can go to. It's www.brainradar.com. Or you can go to neilslade.com as well. We're going to be talking about popping our frontal lobe and other brain games. Neil's going to tell us all about our brain, how it functions, and how we can, you know, actually get more use out of this, you know, big muscle that is in our heads. And we're going to talk to him. He has a lot of things to share with us, and he has this awesome, huge website. So before we bring him out, you know, if you have time, check it out. If you want to join us live, go to www.talkshoe.com, create a free profile. You must be 13 years of age or older to do that. Download the free TalkShoe Live software and follow the instructions. Or you can just dial in, like some people have already, 724-444-7444. Enter our TalkCast ID, which is 33443, and you are follow the prompts, and you're in the room. If you want to chat, then you have to download the TalkShoe Live software. And if you want to, use the Shoe phone attached to your TalkShoe Live software. That is free if you have a mic and a headset, no cost to you. So tonight, we're going to bring our guest out, Neil Swade. And the one thing we all absolutely have in common is we all have a brain. So none of us is like the Scarecrow and the Wizard of Oz without a brain, although at times we may wonder where it is and what it's doing. Or we may meet someone who seems to be missing theirs completely. It's not true. We all have a brain, and our guest tonight is going to talk to us about popping our frontal lobes, our brains, and how we can actually use more of that mass we have in our heads. So we're going to bring Neil on out and chat with him tonight. Hi, Neil. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Hi.
Hi.
Something just said, you are unmuted. That reminds me, my brain, TD Lingo, used to call all the people who studied brain pre-mutants. And the reason why he said people, that us brain explorers were pre-mutants is he felt that the human, we were at a crossroads in the evolution of the species, of Homo sapiens. And those who moved forward from killer ape mentality, he called those people Homo novus. That was the new evolutionary species that came out of Homo sapien. And these were people who made an evolutionary quantum leap inside their own cranium. And so the new direction of evolution was not that you were going to grow a sixth toe or a seventh finger or a third eyeball, but you would actually grow new neural connections in your brain, and that the whole nervous system would be rewired inside the cranium. And again, that's why he called those people who were moving in that direction as pre-mutants.
Sort of like the X-Men.
Sort of, yeah, right, exactly. Yes.
And that new show, Heroes. You know, I always wonder what lies underneath, you know, and what we can really, really accomplish if we use more of our brain power than we actually are.
Well, if we were to believe a Nobel laureate, Sir John Eccles, he told an audience at the University of Colorado in 1972, the potential of the human brain is infinite. So when people would say things like, you only use 10% of your brain, he was indicating that even that was too generous, because how can you calculate a percentage of infinity? Follow what I'm saying?
Right.
If you, even 1% is too generous. The sky is the limit. You have more neural connections in your brain, literally, than there are grains of sand on the planet Earth. So think about the potential of that mind motor. And everybody that you see walking down the street has got that infinity mind motor stuffed in between their two ears, washed or unwashed.
Well, yeah, you know, I was looking on your website, and I don't know, I think you said it was like millions of neurons. I mean, millions in our brain?
You have 200 billion. There are 200, they're roughly, nobody knows for sure, but that's a good estimate, all right? So you got 200 billion neurons inside your head, man or woman or child. Adults actually have a few more because your frontal lobes are still developing until the ages of like 21, 22. So literally an adult has a few more connections than a kid. But still, you know, you're born with roughly 200 billion. Now, a neuron is a nerve cell, right?
Right.
Now, each nerve cell has little arms coming out of it, and that's how it connects to all the other nerve cells. And the way that they, it's kind of like a telephone network, you know, the way that they are connected or talking to each other is, you know, how you get thoughts and ideas and do problem solving. So each one of those neural cells, neurons, has between, you know, 50 and 150,000 connections. So if you do the math, you come up with this, like, astonishing number of combinations by which those 200 billion neurons, each with 100,000 connections average, can be connected. And it's a number that's really too big to conceive of. That, you know, the different ways that your brain can talk to each other, you know, each combination, there's more combinations than there are literal stars in the visible universe. So it's a lot of horsepower there to work with.
And that's just incredible to me. Okay, well, now
what is really amazing is most people can't remember where they put their keys 10 minutes ago.
Right.
Even with that motor. So this is why my teacher, T.D.A. Lingo, named his laboratory, which he ran for 35 years in the wilderness of Colorado. He called it the Dormant Brain Research and Development Laboratory. Because he was trying to figure out why people's brains were so dormant, why we couldn't remember where our keys, why we continued to make war upon each other, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I have a discussion almost every day with one of my pals who lives in Seattle, and he had signed up for the Army in his youth and grew out of that and quit that. And he's quite, I wouldn't say, I don't know that he's a pacifist, but he's a very peace-loving fellow these days. And we were talking, we were trying to figure out if, you know, what the chances are for the human species to survive, you know, another 50 years. This is, you know, are humans going to be around 50 years from now even? And what I observed was I just sort of asked this question of us both. Has, you know, like 50 years ago was World War II, right? And, you know, I don't want to be negative here, but, I mean, let's look at this, you know, very objectively. 50 years ago, 72 million people died in World War II. Okay, if you count everybody up. It wasn't just, you know, the Jews in the concentration camps and our soldiers. I mean, 72 million people total died. And then we had the Korean War after that, and we had Vietnam, and now we're back, and now we're in Iraq. And so my question was, do you think humans as a species have fundamentally evolved in the past 50 years? Or should we expect the same thing to happen again? See? And so my feeling is that, well, no, I don't think humans have fundamentally changed. Basically, you know, we have different technology, and we have a little more experience under our belts, but basically people are the same as they were in 1933 and in 1940, and essentially the same as they were at the beginning of World War One and during the humans haven't changed. The brain motor is essentially still the same. So that's kind of, oh man, when you think about it in those terms, you think, I better get ready for the next one, right? Because this seems to be a regular occurrence that we kill off large numbers of each other, right? And we sort of justify it, you know, as, you know, we needed to do that, and so on and so forth. The only thing I thought of, and I was trying to think of, oh, man, it can't be that bad. And then the only thing I thought of, well, wait a minute. Technology and the Internet and the web has introduced one new element, and that is people can instantaneously communicate with each other without interference of corporations and government. People can talk to people instantly all over the planet. So we're truly a single community in a very different sense in 2007 than we were. It's, in that regard, it's completely new and different. So there is hope. There is hope that people will recognize the truth of their existence and their ability to get along and survive and do it through this medium that we're using right at this very moment. So don't give up just yet. we still may make it.
Well, if more of us learn how to tickle our amygdala, we actually have hope. So thanks to the Internet, we have your website, and more people around the world are accessing it every day.
Well, I read an interesting thing in the paper. This was I think his name was Bill Husted, and he was not the Bill Husted in Denver, but there was another writer, I think, in Miami. And he wrote an article about what news can you trust. And he was saying, well, you can't believe everything on the Internet. And I agree with that. And he was talking about you've got to compare sources and sort of triangulate so that you're not dependent upon one source. And then he goes on to say, you know, you should start out with trusted sources like CNN and, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, wait a second. You know, I think I trust independent, non-business-affiliated news more than I do, you know, corporate news. And so I think what you observed is true. You know, we can use the Internet, and but I think it's important that we really weigh each little bit of information that we get and examine it and really critically think about what we're observing and reading and even writing.
True.
And,
well, I wanted to ask you, since you were talking about TD Lingo, mm-hmm. and how you first started working with him and what you yourself experienced with popping your own frontal lobe.
I met Lingo in around 1982, and I had been out of college for about 10, 12, 14 years. And I was kind of a somewhat discontented, relatively unsuccessful musician. I mean, music is like one of the hardest professions to get your foot in the door and get going. But I was also having some personal problems with relationships. I was having career problems. I wasn't having so much creativity problems because I've always been a pretty artistic and independent and imaginative, you know, creative type of person. So one day I'm sitting around watching public television, and there's this documentary on our local PBS station. And in the documentary is this really wild-looking guy that's got long hair and a beard, and he's up in the mountains in these log cabins. And people are sitting around talking about all these paranormal things that are happening to them, you know, microscopic vision and precognition and clairvoyance and all this stuff. And I'm watching them going, what is this, man? These people are in the woods. So they interviewed him after the documentary. The documentary was about his Brain in Nature lab. And just to quickly make a synopsis, Lingo graduated from the University of Chicago and dropped out at the end of his PhD program in psychology, brain science, and set up his own brain lab, which was located at 10,000 feet elevation in the wilderness, 40 miles west of Denver. And the idea was for him to explore the human brain and to kind of answer the question that he had wondered since he got out of World War II, which was, why must I kill my fellow Earthling in war? So he set up the brain lab to explore this and to explore how to unleash creativity and cooperation and intelligence in the human brain. So that's what the documentary was about, his 35-year experiment at this Brain in Nature lab, where he conducted these workshops and classes and experiments and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So they interviewed him after the show, and then I wrote him a letter, and he invited me up, and I got to know him. And for the next 11 years, I regularly went to the Brain lab and eventually became kind of his Man Friday, is that? I became his leading assistant in doing public presentations and workshops around Denver and doing some educational work. And eventually I wrote a book in 1989 which kind of encapsulated everything that I had learned from the Brain Lab, and I tried to interpret his writings in a way that anyone could understand. His own writing was a little obtuse, I wonder if that's the right word. He had a very idiosyncratic way of writing because he essentially lived by himself, except for the Brain Lab participants, for decades. And so he developed a style of writing that not everybody could relate to. So I sat down one day and on a drive from Durango to Colorado to Denver, Colorado. I had a little tape recorder with me, and I just spoke into the tape recorder everything that I had learned about the brain, you know, from the previous 9 years that I had spent with him. And then I transcribed it, and that was the first brain book that I wrote. And then I've written four other books since then, and I have 20 CDs, and we did a feature film called The Amazing Brain Adventure Movie, and it's just kind of, you know, exploded from there.
I see.
Answer your question?
Yes. Well, for our listeners and, well, for myself as well, because in your book, Frontal Lobe Supercharged, you make it really important that we understand all the parts of the brain and what they are for so that we could get the best out of tickling our amygdala and popping our frontal lobe.
Right.
Would you go over that a little bit?
Oh, sure. It's important that you know just some rudimentary basics about how your mind motor is constructed. Because everything you experience in this corporal body, okay? I mean, I'm not denying that we don't exist on other dimensions and that there's, I'm not denying that there's life before and after, you know, this particular endeavor that we call life. But in our day-to-day experience, everything you experience is through this organ called the brain. Now, you can lose an arm, you can lose your legs, you can lose both arms, both legs, you can have an artificial heart. You can replace everything in your body except for your brain. If your brain goes, you're gone, okay? So everything is filtered through this mind motor. And so it's very important that you understand how that's working in the same way that, you know, if you're going to drive a car, you got to know where to put the key and you got to know where to put the gas, you know, and what you do if you get a flat tire and you know, you have to know some rudimentary things about the car and the engine, right? Or you're not going to go very far.
Right.
What's remarkable is people know nothing about their brain and they go through life and they run into brick walls over and over and over again and they all have all these things. And they can't understand why life is so difficult. Well, Lingo said, hey man, figure out how the motor's working first. That's rudimentary. So get your brain driver's license. Okay. So a very convenient model that we used at the Brain Lab, which I continue to use, is Dr. Paul McLean's model of the human brain, and it's called the triune brain. And Dr. Paul McLean is known for being the director of the Laboratory for Brain Evolution and Behavior. Pretty much everyone agrees with his model of the brain as being a very handy and useful way to look at the brain. The triune brain, triune, three in one. So it's like it's built like an apple, okay? In the middle of an apple, you have the seeds, okay, the dark, hard seeds. And in the middle of your brain, you have this part which is called the reptile brain or the R complex. But you call it the reptile brain because the core of your brain controls all of your basic survival. It regulates your heart, your body temperature. It allows for the fight or flight response, okay? It just really allows you to survive on the most basic level. Even when you're out cold and in a coma or unconscious or sleeping, your reptile brain is still going, and it's maintaining all of these autonomic body functions, okay? The reptile brain allows you to operate on the same level as a snake or a reptile, very basic, no emotions, you know, fight or flight. You know, if you put your hand in a hot flame, your reptile brain kicks in and pulls your hand back. It reacts. It doesn't think, it reacts, okay? That part of your brain is 100% competitive consciousness. It only computes me, 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 me types of behavior. You know, reptiles lay their eggs and split. Kids, you're on your own. You know, it processes basic sexual desires, and I'm talking really basic, okay, so that you can reproduce. Okay, the old neurological joke is the reptile brain computes the four F's of human behavior. Fighting, fleeing, feeding, and reproduction. That's the joke. Okay? The four F's of behavior.
Okay.
So that's the core seeds of the apple, the center part of your reptile brain. Now, around that, There's like a, you know, like how the seeds have a core. The seeds are in the core, and the core goes around the seeds, right? Well, around the reptile brain, you have another layer, the middle layer of the brain, which McLean calls the mammal brain, or the paleo mammalian brain, the old mammal brain. And your dog and your cat, they have a similar structures in their head, okay? They have the first reptile brain, and they have a second layer called the mammal brain. And what this adds on is new processes. And these processes are social, basic social processes and behaviors. and emotions. So you know how your dog can be very happy to see you when you come home and wags his tail, right? And dogs, you know, dogs can feel bad. You know, I mean, the other day my dog accidentally nipped me on the hand, and he knew he did bad, and he felt really bad, and he went and sat in the corner. So dogs and mammals can have these emotions, okay? Whereas reptiles are just cold. They don't have any emotions. But mammals also have basic social skills. Dogs and, you know, run in packs. Wolves hunt together. I mean, go to the zoo, watch mammals. They interact with each other. Reptiles don't. They just sit on the rock and bake in the sun. Okay? So that's the difference between the mammal brain processes, okay, which is much more complex than the basic reptile brain processes. What I say is the mammal brain computes 50% competitive consciousness, but 50% cooperative consciousness as well, right? You know, your dog can cooperate with you and with other dogs, right? But sometimes they click backwards and they go full into reptile brain, right? Try to take food out of your dog's mouth. See what part of his brain he's using. He's not using his mammal brain anymore. He's all of a sudden take the food away and it's 100% reptile. So a creature with a mammal brain, you know, the mammal brain is like 50-50. Just depending upon the environmental influences, all right? But the mammal, most mammals really just don't have control over that. Now, primates, like humans, have a third layer of brain. And this is kind of like the fruit and the skin of the apple, all the fruity part. And it actually makes up like 60% of your brain volume. So this third layer, which is around the core, which is the good, delicious part of the apple to eat, are you getting my model there in terms of, you know, the mammal brain and the reptile brain together only make up, I think it's only like 20.
The skinny part of the core.
Yeah.
They
make up 1/6. I'm sorry. I was forgetting my percentages. The mammal brain and reptile brain together make up 1/6 of the brain. The other 5/6 are this big primate layer. You know, when you look at a, you know, Frankenstein's brain in a jar, right? Everybody can think of a movie where they, right? You're looking at this primate, you're looking at the gray matter, and underneath that is a 2-inch thick layer of what's called glial cells. Right? So the first inch and a half of brain meat on the outside is this primate brain. And that adds on much more developed processes of mammal brain behavior. So for example, in humans, we develop these basic mammal social structures into hospitals and police forces and schools, right? McLean calls that the neo-mammalian brain, the new mammal brain. Now, if you grab your forehead, okay, with one of your hands and just spread your fingers apart, hold your forehead. Everything under your hands, the whole front one-third bulk of your primate brain is called the frontal lobes. And that's the most advanced part of your brain. It's much more advanced than the brain that chimps and gorillas have. Even though we share 98% of the genetic material with chimpanzees, we have a much more developed brain. You know, a chimp's brain, skull rather, goes back from it's a slant from the eyebrows, right? Think of the way that a chimpanzee or gorilla's skull is shaped. That whole big forehead is missing. But humans have it, and it's filled up with this part called the prefrontal cortex, or frontal lobes for short. That's the most advanced part of your brain. And what that adds on are what I call CICIL, C-I-C-I-L, creativity, imagination, cooperation, intuition, and logic. C-I-C-I-L.
That's all in the front part.
It's like the whole frontal lobes. The development of the frontal lobes is what sets us apart from all the other mammals on the planet. Except perhaps for, you know, look at a dolphin's skull. Okay, now their brain is structurally very different from ours, but they do also have, dolphins and whales also have a very big, bulky frontal lobes. So I'm not going to say we're smarter than every creature on the planet, but in general, humans have this big mass of frontal lobes that no other animal has. So it adds on these skills. So it adds on our ability for abstract thinking. In other words, to think of, to visualize and think of things that is beyond our senses. We can imagine what's happening in the house next door. We can imagine what's going to happen 10 years from now. In other words, we can travel up and down the timeline, right, because we've got this frontal lobe. It allows us to conceive of concepts of time, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It allows us to calculate cause and effect. Well, if I connect this to this to this, this is going to happen, right? No other animals can do that, you know, anywhere near the ability that humans have. Other lower animals, and I say lower, you know, with a certain reservation, but other mammals that don't have this big bulk of frontal lobes, they're very limited in their ability for abstract thinking and concepts of time and problem solving and so on. That's what our frontal lobes do, okay? All right, so now we've got the basic structure of the brain. We've got reptile brain surrounded by mammal brain, surrounded by this big primate brain and frontal lobes, okay? Now, obviously, you want to use the most, if you're going through the game of life, right, you want to have all 10 spark plugs connected.
Right.
You want to be using all of that potential. You want to be able to use all of that horsepower that you have available. You don't want to be just using that 5% of reptile brain, right? That's why you got, you know, that's why all of this is there, is because it was evolutionarily advantageous to have more brain mass, right? Now, the cosmic joke is, we don't use it. That's the great cosmic joke. Why can't I find my keys? Well, because you're not using your brain potential, okay? You haven't trained yourself to put a little nail next to your front door, and every time you walk in, you put the keys on that hook, and you never lose your keys again, right? We fail
right.
to teach ourselves certain things to help us survive. We haven't seen the cause for losing our keys or whatever problem it is. We haven't bothered to use our frontal lobes to do the problem solving. Okay, so the way that you increase the amount of frontal lobes processes in your brain, the way you turn on the other 90% of your brain, right, is through a little master click switch that's situated right smack in the middle of your brain. And actually, you've got two switches, and they're called amygdala. Amygdala meaning one, but you really have two amygdala in your brain. One in the left hemisphere of your mammal brain, and one in the right hemisphere of your mammal brain. See, everything in the mammal brain and the primate brain is divided in half, brain hemispheres, left and right brain, right? Everybody knows
right.
left and right brain.
Right.
The mammal brain is not split. It's just one kind of core. I mean, the reptile brain, I don't know what I said. The reptile brain is just one centrally located piece, kind of what's extending up through your spinal cord. But the mammal brain and the primate brain are split into hemispheres. So each hemisphere has its own master click switch, has its own amygdala. And the amygdala is about the size of the tip of your thumb. And if people go to my website, they go to brainradar.com, go down the index until you see Find Your Amygdala Here. And amygdala is spelled A-M-Y-G-D-A-L-A. Amygdala, all right? And you can actually see pictures, and I just put up a movie 2 days ago. You can see an animated movie and find exactly where those amygdala are located inside your skull. Okay? Now, what that amygdala is, kind of like a central hub. It's connected to the most advanced parts of your brain, and it's connected to the most primitive parts of your brain. It's smack right in the middle of your mammal brain. Okay? And what the amygdala is, it's kind of like a thermostat. You know, think about your thermostat on your wall. What does it do? It tells you what the temperature is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thermostats
right.
have a little thermometer on them, right? But they also allow you to increase the heat, right, or bring down the heat. And in many cases, it could turn on your air conditioning or bring down your conditioning, right? It's
right.
controlling where energy is flowing in your house. The amygdala is kind of like a click switch on your wall, right? Electricity comes into your house, and it's sitting in your basement, right? And then you can click this little switch on your wall, and the electricity moves up into the light fixture on your ceiling. And then it lights up, and you can see where everything is in your living room, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the click switch is really a variable rheostat, which means it has an infinite number of positions off, between off and fully on. It's like a dimmer switch, really, as opposed to an on-off click switch. But it's easy to think of it as a, hear my click switch? Hear my amygdala?
Right.
All right? Okay. So,
it's more, too, like you can, you don't necessarily have to click it. It's not necessarily always clicked all the way back or always clicked all the way forward.
That's right. Most of the time, though, this is the case. Most of the time, it's somewhere in that middle position. But when you're doing, you know, like brain self-control, when you're trying to increase your frontal lobes process,
mm-hmm.
all you have to do is think, okay, I'm going to click my amygdala forward. Okay? And what that does is that allows electrochemical processes to come up from the reptile brain, which is on all the time. Like that's like the electricity coming in from public service company, right? Comes to your house, it gets as far as your midbrain, right? And then either it will click forward into your frontal lobes where you compute advanced brain processes, or it just stays in the midbrain, or it even clicks backwards. You know, if somebody comes at you with a baseball bat, your amygdala is genetically programmed to click fully backwards. And then 100% of your brain energy is being computed by your reptile brain in fight or flight into pure defensive behavior, okay?
Okay.
The trick, though, is to have conscious control over that click switch. Otherwise, you're no better than your dog. You're just reacting with the environment, you know? We're supposed to be humans with free will. We're supposed to do what is in our best long-term interest, in our best interest of survival of ourselves and the species. Well, you can only do that if you can get that electrochemical energy to go all the way into the most part, the furthest part of your advanced frontal lobes. The big problem is, as a species, we are culturally conditioned to keep our amygdala clicked backwards.
Mm.
Turn on your TV, okay? Turn on your typical radio. Open up your newspaper. Open up Time Magazine. Everywhere society is saying the way that you solve problems is to click backwards. Be the Terminator. Kill, 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 you know? In so many words, right? You know, I'm not going to be completely down on sports, but our society is completely obsessed with competitive consciousness as opposed to cooperative consciousness. We're trained from the time we're born to compete with each other, to that might makes right, that the guy with the biggest gun is correct. Aren't we? Society and culture keeps us clicked backwards. So that's the challenge for every pre-mutant, is to say, hey, I'm getting off this bus.
Right.
Follow what I'm saying? I know what my brain is doing. I know what my brain is capable of. And if I look around every day, I see people clicking backwards, and they're trying to get through life not by using their creativity, not by using their imagination, not by using their cooperation, intuition, or logic, but they're trying to get through life with with reactive, brute force, me, reptile brain consciousness. And that is an evolutionary dead end. If people continue along that route, human beings are going to end up like the dinosaurs. And let me tell you something. Dinosaurs were around a lot longer than humans have been. I don't know if humans are going to be as successful as dinosaurs at this stage. You know, so I'm flattering people when I say, hey, you're going to be extinct as the dinosaurs before long. Because apparently it's a lethal combination to have this enormous infinite brain potential, but however is at the mercy of reptile brain problem solving.
Mm.
It's like giving your 4-year-old kid the keys to your Ferrari. You know, he's only going to get as far as the first fire hydrant he runs into. You know,
true.
So the trick for the human species is, hey, listen, nature has given us this fabulous tool, this fabulous brain. You know, are you smart? Can you handle it? You know, so you know that's we're just going to have to see.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I think that about wraps up brain basics right there. So that's your starting point. And basically what I talk about on my website is, you know, what happens when you dump this cultural conditioning to click backwards and start to consciously click your amygdala forward and turn on your frontal lobes? What types of experiences happen to you? And I talk about my own personal experiences, and I talk about other people's experiences from the brain lab. And the website has had millions of visitors now in the past 10 years. And I draw upon thousands of stories and emails and share that with people. So I'll shut up now.
No.
We don't want to shut up. We're loving it.
Well, I wanted to just... if you could explain a little bit about the feather exercise.
Okay.
And tickling your amygdala.
Sure. Okay, yeah, everybody wants to know. Pardon me, I just took a bite of my sandwich here. Let me swallow. My reptile brain is saying, feed me. Okay. So the first question is, everybody has, how do I click my amygdala forward? Okay. Oh, I left out one very important thing. Let me say this first. Nature is very smart. The design of the brain is such that it rewards behavior that increases your ability to survive, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it discourages behavior that gets in the way, that retards your ability to survive, right? Because nature wants you to survive. Your body, your brain wants you to survive. So you have this built-in mechanism that if you do something that increases your chances of survival, your brain makes you feel good. You experience long-term pleasure. That's the function of all these neuroreceptors inside the pleasure mechanisms inside the brain that sit right next to the amygdala. Okay? If you do something... Now think about this. This is just, to me, this is like the most amazing thing. If you do something that is good for society and good for yourself, you feel good. Now,
right.
You have to make the distinction that it's a pleasurable feedback that is long term. Anybody can go out and have 5 beers and they're going to feel great for the moment. But a couple hours later, they're going to feel like crap,
mm-hmm.
right? So just doing stuff short-term is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about pleasurable feedback that doesn't come with a hangover, all right? When you write a book, when you help an old lady across the street, when you figure out the speed of light, when you write a new piece of music, okay, when you go canvassing door to door for your political candidate who wins, right, you feel good long term. Your brain is rewarding you. It says, yeah, go this way, man, because look, you're helping the species to survive. Okay? Now, the exact opposite is true. When you do something that that gets in the way of your personal survival or species survival, you're reprimanded by your brain. When you're bored, when you get in a fight with somebody, when you argue with someone needlessly, when you destroy something, you feel negative feedback from your brain. Your brain tells you almost instantaneously in most cases, hey, don't do this because it's going to make you feel like crap. Okay? This is the way that the midbrain monitors your behaviors and encourages you to move in the direction that increases your survival and discourages you from having a brain that is not turned on correctly. I mean, think about the last time you felt really good, okay? Let's just take 10 seconds. Think about your last pleasurable experience. Got it? Okay, now, think about how that relates to your triune brain experience. Were you doing something that involved creativity, imagination, cooperation, your intuition perhaps, or logic? Were you doing something that helped, that utilized these frontal lobes processes? Right? I would bet dollars to donuts you were. You can look at all of your pleasurable experiences in life, and I'm talking again about these long-term things, not the ones that came with the hangover, right?
Mm-hmm.
Each one of those has a direct connection to frontal lobes, cooperation, imagination, creativity, intuition, and logic. They all require these frontal lobes' advanced brain processes. So there's the most important connection that you can make in terms of your brain. Your brain rewards you for using the most advanced parts of your brain. You feel good. And the thing is, it's accumulative. So as you use your frontal lobes processes more and more, you build a permanent neural pathways and you make it easier to use these frontal lobes processes and they become habitual. And suddenly you find that, oh, this isn't a problem anymore. I solved that one. Oh, and I solved this one over here because all your creative problem solving is in your frontal lobes, right? So you accumulate all of these solutions, right, and you're changing the actual physical wiring inside your brain. And one day, it's like the straw that breaks the camel's back. One day you've connected enough of these new neural pathways that it's kind of like I'm trying to think of a, you know, do you ever have your car snowed in on the street? And I suppose it depends where you live, but your car is blocked.
New York, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, you get out there with your snow shovel, right? And you move all the snow out of the way, and suddenly you can drive into the street, right? Or like, for example, okay, when the snow is really heavy on the road, the first person to drive the car into the road, it's kind of rough, right? But as soon as a few cars drive, they make a path because they keep driving over the same road. And suddenly, after a while, everybody can get around really easily. Well, it's the same way in your brain. When you first start out trying to solve a problem or a set of problems, it's kind of tough, but you do it again, and you do it again, and suddenly you can drive up and down the neural highway, right? And at some point, you have a breakthrough experience. And every culture has a name for this peak experience. The Native Americans call this medicine vision. Zen masters call it a satori. The Hindus call it samadhi. Christians call it born again. You know, if you're an atheist, you call it a peak experience. So every culture has a name for this breakthrough peak experience. And what we call it in our brain circle, we don't deny any of those experiences. We just call it frontal lobes transcendence. You pop your frontal lobes. So you click your amygdala forward, and this is an important distinction for people to make. Clicking your amygdala forward is not the same thing as this big brain bang. Clicking is something that you just do day after day, and it's really easy, and it only takes a second, and I'll tell people how to do it in a second, right? So you just click from day to day, but you accumulate all these new neural connections and use all these little problems, and you take all the, and one day, boom, you have this big peak transcendent experience, and it's like the big light bulb going off in the sky, okay? And you have one of those things. And essentially, it's just a matter of teaching yourself how to, you know, break through one of these stubborn life blocks that you have, regardless of what it is. And there's a billion variations. You know, everybody has their own block to work through in this life. You know, maybe it was an abused childhood. Maybe it was a crappy job that you have that you don't like. Maybe it's a physical handicap. Maybe it's a mental handicap. Everybody's got one. We're sort of like, you know, hey, man, you can count on it. If you're Paris Hilton, you know, your block is you've got too much damn money. <You know? laughs> So everybody's got that. So if you know how to click your amygdala forward and get that juice going into the most advanced part of the brain, you build up a lot of, you accumulate all these positive new neural circuits, and one day, bam, you get the big brain bang, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So now we come back to your question. Well, how do you click your amygdala forward? How do we get started? Well, it's really simple. It's like so simple you don't believe it when you first hear it, okay? Everybody listening, I'm going to tell you how to click your amygdala forward. This is the most surefire, easiest way to do it. Anybody can do it. You can teach a kindergartner how to do this. Imagine you have, and here we go. Imagine you're holding a feather in your hand. Doesn't matter which hand. And
okay.
See that feather that you're holding. Okay, now see what color feather that is. Is it a white feather? Is it black? Is it rainbow colored? Okay, can you see the color? Okay, now take your other hand and move it up and down the feather. You know how a feather feels? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that you can stroke that feather and you feel those kind of light ridges, okay, up and down the quill of the feather, all right? Okay, now take that feather and I want you to do is I want you to go in through your forehead with the tip of the feather. Pretend that feather can go right through the front of your forehead and reach back so that the tip of the feather is touching this little walnut-shaped protuberance inside your brain that's 1 inch inside each temple, right in between the back of your eyeball and your ear. 1 inch inside each temple. Okay, you have your right. So let's do the right amygdala. And what you're going to do is you're going to just touch the feather to that right amygdala, that little almond part of your brain, and you're going to tickle, 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 tickle in front of it. All right? Now, take the feather and now go to the other side of your brain and go in through your forehead and put the tip of that feather on the other amygdala and go tickle, 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 tickle. Okay? Now, you laughed, okay? Did you know that laughter is a frontal lobes process? That if you laugh, you are engaging the most advanced part of your brain. Your laughter was proof that you just clicked your amygdala forward. Now, you don't have to laugh every time, but you just gave a great example. People who have had frontal lobotomies in which their frontal lobes are severed from the rest of their brain, they lose their sense of humor. They can't laugh anymore. Isn't that interesting? Laughter engages your frontal lobes, and you just showed the world that you just closed your amygdala for. Now, you can, that's it. I mean, you did it. The reason why in this
case, we click on amygdala, I click my amygdala forward, then I must click it forward often because I laugh a lot in the show.
That's very possible. It's very probable. You know, the reason why that little exercise clicks your amygdala forward is because where is your imagination? It's a frontal lobes process. It's abstract thinking. It's imagining something that lays beyond your senses, for which there is no sensory information. I mean, really, there's no feather in your hand. I mean, there could be. But if you imagined a feather, boom, you just did it. You just clicked your amygdala forward because you're using the most advanced part of your brain. So it's kind of, so that feather clicking exercise is a catalyst. It's like pushing the starter button on your old Triumph TR3. It's like turning the key in the ignition of your car. It just starts the engine. So the trick here is you prime the engine with the amygdala clicking exercise to get the energy flowing into your frontal lobes. And once it starts flowing, it's like a siphon. The energy starts and then it just keeps going on its own. And if you do that exercise enough, what will happen is you'll automatically click your amygdala forward when you need to problem solve, and you won't even think twice that, hey, I need to click my amygdala forward.
So, like, it's helpful, like, even if, say we have a problem, we're trying to figure something out.
Yeah.
The easiest way to do that, then, would be if we've practiced enough, is to go ahead and click our amygdala forward.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then we'll find the answer, or our brain will help us create the answer.
Okay, so, well, feather clicking is one of many, many, and I should say infinite ways to click your amygdala forward, okay? It's just, it's kind of the tool that you use to remind you that there's another way rather than reactive reptilian response.
Right.
To get from point A to point B. You understand? Okay? It just starts the engine. Okay, so you know, you're instead of banging your head against a wall when you come up against a problem, which you are going to, if you wake up in the morning, you're going to have problems that need to be solved every single day. Okay? You can get bummed out about them. You can bang your head against the wall. You can have a war every single day, right? Or you can click your amygdala forward and use the other 90% of your brain and figure out, maybe this is how I can solve this problem. You know, the whole idea is that you're plugging in all those frontal lobes spark wires, which culture and society would tell you, no, let's just have a fight. Let's just fight it out until we win. You know.
Well, we have some questions in the room for you too.
Okay, I'm ready.
The other thing I wanted to say is this is one of the things that we do in the room on our show every week is we do 17 seconds of pure positive thought, feeling good thought. And I guess if you're smiling or if you're feeling good, that's clicking your amygdala forward. So what we're going to do is add this exercise in too into the show every week.
That sounds fabulous.
I think so.
Incredible. No, you know, I really suggest if you've got a computer, and obviously if you're listening to the show, you do, go to my website. You don't have to buy anything. I mean, you can, but you don't have to. You could spend I don't know if you've done it, but it would take you a couple weeks to get through the whole website.
Oh, I haven't gotten through it all. I don't think Diana has either.
Yeah, I mean, there's music, there's art, there's articles, there's photography, there's links to other brain pages. You can spend an awful lot of time. I mean, if I want to look up an article on my website, I have to do a Google search for it. No, I swear to God, I had to do that. I was looking. Today was my father's birthday, and I thought of a really great brain story about how my. I think you talked very early on about other dimensions or what was it at the beginning of the story of the show? You were talking about existing on other planets.
Oh, we're all spiritual?
Excuse me?
That we're all spiritual?
Yeah, I think you alluded to the fact that we're just not, you know, single dimensional beings. You didn't say it in that,
right.
You didn't put it exactly that way.
Oh, I said that we're non physical beings having physical human experience.
Oh, absolutely. Right. That's what I was thinking about. So on my father's, I'll tell this story very quickly. And I was trying to find the link on my webpage, but I can't find it. I've got this one page called A Library from Another Dimension, and there's like hundreds of articles on this page. And I know in there somewhere there is a story about my father. Let's see, was it on my, I think it was on, well, let me tell you the story. It was on my mother's birthday. And my father just died the previous. Oh, okay. Now I just remembered another part of the story, which is so mind-boggling you wouldn't believe it. This was on my mother's birthday, and my father just died the previous year. And so we go to this, and I'll make this story short because I know you have people who want to ask questions. So on my mother's. It was like a couple days before my mother's birthday, we go down to this museum, and it's got a show about the 1920s, okay? And they've got all these kind of knickknacks and all this paraphernalia, and they had some magazines from the 20s, right, and from the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are the Saturday Evening Post, right? And so my mother turns to me, and she says, you know, I think your father once told me that when he was a little boy, an artist came and painted his picture and ended up on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post. I think he told me that once. And I never remembered that story, and she had just remembered it, right? So I said, really? Oh, that's kind of interesting. Yeah, and she said, yeah, he was a caddy. And the picture was him carrying a bag of golf clubs. And my father ended up being like this fanatical golfer, and he actually won the New Jersey State Pro Amateur Championship one year. I mean, he lived for golf. Okay, so I said, "Well, that's interesting." So the next day, I went down to the public library and I started going through these old issues of the Saturday Evening Post. And I turn the page, and all of a sudden I get to this issue, and there he is. And I even recognized the space in between his middle teeth. And it was the picture exactly as my mother had described it. And he was the exact age that he would have been. And I said, that's him. That's my dad. And this is the picture, right? So I go to a magazine place. And I actually get a copy that I can purchase of the magazine. Oh, by the way, when I found the picture, I yelled so loud that I'm sure everyone in the library heard me. Like, that's my dad! <You know? laughs> So on my mother's birthday, I show up at her house, and she comes home, and sitting on her kitchen table is the Saturday Evening Post with the picture of my father. And it was like he was coming back to wish my mother a happy birthday. The way that the stars had aligned, I found this, and I couldn't have gotten her a better present. But that's not the end of the story. Later on, it was my birthday, right? And I had a telephone answering machine. And for some reason, I got up, and I went to my telephone answering machine, and back in those days, you put a cassette in it. And I don't know why, but for some reason I got it in my head. I said, you know, I think it's time to turn the tape over because this side of the tape is getting kind of worn, right? Because the messages were starting to get garbled because I played the tape so many times. So I said, I think I should turn the tape over. So I flipped the tape over in the answering machine, right? This is on my birthday. And I just play it to see if there's anything on that side of the tape. And the first thing I hear on the tape recorder is my father's voice. And he says, "Happy birthday, Neil."
Wow.
All right?
Wow.
Now it's like, wait a minute. How did that get there? No, the problem was,
because he's not gone, he's still here.
He's still here. Probably in all likelihood, he had recorded that message my previous birthday, right? But what made me turn that tape over that particular morning and turn on the tape? Out of 365 days, I decided on my birthday to do it. I had no idea that message, except way, 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 way back in the subconscious archives of my brain that has so many connections, I can't even remember. Somewhere in my brain, it said, hey, it's your birthday. Your father's got a message for you. That's how incredible the brain is. Now, if you could tap into that kind of know-how and go through your daily experience using what that incredible potential, life will become absolute magic. And when we talked on the email a few weeks ago, I said, you know, what people don't realize is that, you know, that story of Harry Potter that was so popular in the movies, that ain't just a story.
Right.
If you click your amygdala forward, that becomes reality, and life is, it will blow your mind. And it's not...
See, that's what I'm talking about.
It's not difficult. It's really just a matter of keeping that amygdala clicked forward so that your brain radar is on. Everybody's brain radar is turned off. It's easy. All that magical stuff happens as automatically as me just going in and flipping the tape over. It's not hard. Man, it's like people are so used to driving around with five of their spark plug wires disconnected when they plug the other spark plug wires in, and the car suddenly can go 70 miles an hour. Whoa, you're flying. That's what it's like, you know? So, okay.
Awesome. Hey, Angela.
Hello.
You have a question for Neil?
Yes.
Thanks for calling
yes.
in.
Hi, Angela.
Questions. Yes, I came in the middle of the show. Now, by doing this, will it help you? I mean, is this like a thing to help you with your memory? I mean, or will it help you like with your memory?
Well, gosh, I remembered something that I even consciously couldn't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, what do you think about my dad? That's how much your memory will improve, that you'll remember things that you don't even try to remember.
Right, because I have a problem with that.
Absolutely.
Also,
you know, there are systems that are designed, and there's you can go to the library, and there are excellent books on increasing memory.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's one of your goals, I would definitely recommend that. You know, I'm not saying don't do that. The thing is, when you click your amygdala forward and you turn on your potential, everything gets better. You remember the things that you need to remember, and you forget the things that you need to forget.
Cool.
Right? Mm. You know, like last week, you know, I'm not going to lay all the blame on our host here. She did tell me, but I did forget, right? And then I thought, well, okay, why did I forget? Well, hey, the subject got two shows, you know?
Right.
Normally, if I get an interview, we'll talk about it for one show. You know, I mean, it was kind of to everyone's advantage because this topic got double coverage. So I think there was a higher
right.
part of me that forgot something. I call it a cosmic correction. When something happens that on the surface you think is a mistake, but if you examine it a little deeper, you say, hey, you know, that actually was to my advantage. That's actually better. So memory is a kind of, you know, is a kind of a funny thing in that way. You want to remember where you put your keys. You want to remember your best friend's birthday, you know, but you don't want to become too obsessed with remembering all the names in your telephone book.
Yeah. And one more question. I have a really, really hard time concentrating. I mean, like adult ADD or something.
Mm-hmm.
Would this be beneficial for that as well?
Yeah, well, ADD, attention deficit disorder, when I've looked at this subject, my conclusion is that it's really... Attention deficit is, you know, some people who, we like to put labels on things.
Yeah.
Okay? I would say, and I'm making a very general statement here, that when you can't concentrate on something, it's because you're really not interested in that thing. That you've got other things that are drawing your attention away from it. A lot of times we label kids as being attention deficit in school because the kid is not interested in some boring topic that some boring teacher is delivering in some totally boring way. So, oh, yeah, that kid's got ADD because he doesn't want to learn what happened on Saturday, April 5th at 1546, you know. So I think you got to be very careful there. I think... what is really key in improving your concentration is to find those things that you are really that really turn you on, that give you that positive emotional feedback, okay, and that you let yourself go in the direction of those things which give you that long-term pleasure feedback. You follow what I'm saying? So it's very important that you start to tune in to the type of emotional feedback your brain is giving to you. And as you do that, I believe that your concentration will improve. You also have to, if you use your, if you turn on your frontal lobes, if you click your amygdala forward, you're going to problem solve and you're going to discover the cause of your inability to concentrate. You're going to see what, you know, what is causing that problem? If you can't analyze with either intuition or logic that those situations that are keeping you from concentrating, you know, you've got to analyze. You've got to be able to use your brain and problem solve, and that's definitely a frontal lobes process, and the way you get there is by clicking forward and understanding what the frontal lobes are doing.
Okay.
Does that make sense? I taught music and art for over 30 years. And believe you me, I've had lots and lots and lots of experience with kids who you could barely get to sit still in a chair for a half hour. Okay? Kids who had terrible problems concentrating. And the solution in every single one of those cases was to grab the attention of that child and make him interested in that thing. And if you could make him interested in that thing, then they were able to concentrate.
Hmm.
So I think that's
well, I was going to say you seem to concentrate really well when you're baking.
You would be really, really surprised. I have a real problem doing, like, one thing at one time. When I bake...
Oh, I belong to that club, I'll tell you.
Yeah. when a lot of times when I'm baking, I cannot, like, say, for instance, if I'm doing one cookie, I usually have a couple of mixers going at one time.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, while one thing is doing something, I'm usually doing something else. If you watch me, I'd probably give you a headache. But I've had this problem for quite a while. Especially, you know, when I'm reading. I'm not really big on reading because of that. One book that really, really did touch me and I was able to try to concentrate on a little bit was one book by Lana Van Zant, and it was very, very interesting to me. But many times I would just have to stop because every little thing, every little noise, every little, you know, everything, it just, it gets me. You know what I mean?
Well,
so it's a real problem. It's a real problem for me, and that's one reason I have problems sleeping as well, because every little thing, every little noise, whatever, it gets my attention.
Sure, that I don't know that's. I think that sounds more like I'm not going to pretend to be a psychological analyst for you, but to me that sounds more like a response to environmental stimulus that's too high, as opposed to attention, some sort of global attention deficit.
Yeah, I was thinking of funny when I said that, by the way.
It sounds like you're very, very sensitive. You're a very sensitive person.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to, tune out things that are distracting, I think it would be very helpful for you to really sit down and start to analyze the situation. So in on the website and in my books and so on, I suggest different methods by which people can analyze problems. Very simply, one thing that a lot of people don't do is they don't keep a written record. Pretend like you are a scientist conducting an experiment. Write down what the problem is and then start listing, the details of each aspect of the problem, and then try various solutions to change the outcome of the experiment, and keep a very detailed written record. So that's one way to deal with it. The other way, another way is to engage cooperative consciousness. We talked about cooperation. The most cooperative part of your brain is your frontal lobes. That engages, if you're doing something by yourself, if you're solitary, well, that's like using just the reptilian part of your brain, because reptiles are not social creatures. If you want to engage a more advanced part of your brain, engage your social skills. So bring other people in to your experiment and say, hey, what would you do in this situation? And then start getting feedback from different people. Go to the internet. Go to the library. Start bringing in information from a variety of sources that lie outside yourself. You see, that's using the cooperative aspects of your brain, which are more advanced than the solitary reptilian parts of your brain. Start to engage your imagination. Start to engage music, for example. This is very interesting. There's a book called Super Learning that came out a long time ago. And what they found that was that people who were studying, for example, a foreign language, if they studied rhythmically in time to Baroque music that had a beat of 60 beats per second, it dramatically increased their retention of information. So that's one way that you can use music. And music is processed by your frontal lobes. It's a very advanced brain process, okay? By introducing music as part of your solution, you then move forward. You might be able to find that certain types of music increase your concentration, and other types of music decrease your concentration. So make that part of your experiment, okay? There's a million... As soon as you start to think about things in terms of what my frontal lobes can do, you start introducing frontal lobes behaviors, you click forward into your frontal lobes, and that becomes part of your problem-solving solution. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, well, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Ms. Angela.
Thanks, Angela.
Thank you.
I tried to say hello to her, but I was muted.
another thing too is too. Hey, humor. We were just talking about humor. Humor is the frontal lobes process. I used humor all the time when I was teaching kids, especially kids who couldn't sit still. If you can make kids laugh, you get their attention. If you can, if you're having a negative state of mind, put on something funny. Put on Monty Python. Put on your favorite comedy show. Listen to read something funny. So, you know, humor. You have to start thinking in terms of, what do my frontal lobes do, right? You know,
right.
What's happening in the frontal lobes? And if you can introduce those elements into your problem-solving scenario, you know, you're going to zoom ahead.
That's a good way to remind yourself, you know. What are my frontal lobes doing?
Yeah.
What's going on in the front of my frontal lobes?
Well, the key to that is just monitor your emotional feedback, because your emotions are going to tell you which part of your brain you're using. If you're experiencing pleasure without hangover, that's going to be my new saying, pleasure without hangover. If you're going to monitor, if you're experiencing pleasure without hangover, then you're clicked forward. If you're experiencing negative emotion, then you're clicked backwards. Boredom, fear, depression, lovelessness, meaninglessness, these are all negative emotions. You know, boredom, you don't think of as being an emotion, but it is. It's the absence of positive emotion. So if you don't have any positive emotion, your frontal lobes are not turned on. So just first monitor your emotional feedback, and when necessary, tickle your amygdala.
Okay.
That about covers it. I don't think we have anything else to.
Well, there's someone here that asked, can you be in
But I'm saying, you know, that's really that's the simplest way to look at it. Monitor your emotional brain feedback, and then when necessary, click your amygdala forward. Tickle your amygdala, you know. Lingo used to use the visualization of a laser beam needle. That you take this laser beam needle and you stick it in the front of your amygdala, you know. And I thought, man, that would hurt.
That's not fun.
Let's use a feather, man.
I definitely like the feather. Thank you. Thank you for coming up with that one.
Yeah, that's my contribution to brain self control. I thought of the feather.
Someone asked, can't you be in the middle having fun but also worried about something else at the same time?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
That's how most of us are walking around, though I tend to not want to do that anymore.
Yeah, no.
I don't like that. Underlying feeling.
Well, not only can you be kind of in the middle, you know, where your amygdala has kind of clicked a little bit forward.
Yeah.
You know, in reality, it's only clicked a tiny bit forward. Most of it is just, you know, you just don't have much of your frontal lobes going. I mean, you know, we go to work, most of us. That's where we are during most of work, you know. We're kind of, there's no frontal lobes going. That's why I said it was like a rheostat. But not only can you be kind of in the middle, but your left amygdala operates independently of your right amygdala. Your left and right operate independently. You can take somebody like Mozart, for example, right? His left frontal lobes, or I guess it would have been his, well, musicians process music differently than other people, but one of his musical hemisphere was clicked forward, way forward. You know, he could write a symphony playing pool, right, playing billiards. But, man, he couldn't manage his money, right? His analytical, left brain that did his bookkeeping, it was, you know, it was way backwards. I mean, he died penniless. Einstein, for example, his left analytical brain was way forward. He was figuring out all these just amazing mathematical computations, but yet sometimes he couldn't even remember how to get home from class at Princeton, right? He'd go teach and he'd get lost walking home. His right brain, spatial brain, was like, you know, totally disconnected, right? So, you know, your left and right brain can operate independently. You might have a left hemisphere that's really doing good, but a right hemisphere that's doing really bad. So one of the things I stress is to become familiar with the differences between left brain and right brain processing, Okay. And make sure that you're using both. You know, frontal lobes is intuition and logic. Right?
Gotcha.
One's linear, the other is, well, I don't know what the opposite of linear is, but it's kind of like everywhere.
One is everywhere. Well, we have a couple more people that want to talk to you. I think I'm going to just click on real quick to see if Miss South Carolina has a question, and then I'm going to ask Karen, and that is it. Hi, South Carolina.
Hey, yes. No, I'm just listening.
Just
listening. I'm enjoying it.
Hi.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, I've enjoyed it, yes.
Cool.
Thank you.
Oh, no question, just a positive
comment? Yeah, that was a positive comment. She loved
it.
She's enjoying it.
Thank you very much. You know, I have to say, I've been on this car painting forum for a couple of days. Believe it or not, and this, to me this is a total miracle, I probably have the number one book on the internet on how to paint your car.
Wow.
And the reason is, years ago, I had this little old British sports car, and I wanted to learn how to paint it because I didn't have enough money. I didn't have $4,000 lying around to have some professional vintage car guy, you know, restore my vehicle. So I learned how to paint my car. And I built a web page on it, and for a couple of years, you know, I sort of ignored the web page.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had photos and I had the story. One day I go, look, I'm getting 15,000 hits a month on my How to Paint a Car web page.
Wow.
And I thought, man, I better write a book and make a couple bucks. So anyway, I went on from time to time I'll go on a web forum and I'll talk about how to paint your car, you know, how to learn how to paint a car yourself. So a couple days ago I went on this one forum, like it was in Hawaii, and somebody asked how to paint the rear bumper of the car, and I put in a few comments. Well, there's somebody on the forum who was like, who didn't like me, you know, telling, I guess he worked at a automotive car painting place. And he was kind of like the resident expert on that forum. And he didn't like it that I came on.
Oh, he didn't like you giving out the secrets.
No, because it's not, you know, which is kind of surprising, because all the people I know here who are professional painters, they don't care, you know, because, I mean, there's
right.
work involved. They're not trying to, you know, convince somebody to do something that, you know, to spend, you know, a lot of money on something they don't need. But this guy didn't like it, and he starts kind of, you know, trashing me on this website. And then all these other guys kind of joined in. It was like pile on Neil Slade, you know?
Wow.
And it's a very interesting thing that people seem to get this sort of, it's like culturally
mob
conditioned.
Mob mentality?
Yeah, mob mentality. It's like, oh yeah, let's beat up this guy, you know? So it's really wonderful and refreshing when somebody has something nice to say.
Aww. We are all enjoying you, so thank you.
Well, they didn't. They were clicked backwards. That was their problem.
Oh, well, absolutely. Well, you know what it is? I mean, listen, and I've said this many times. At the Brain Lab, we statistically looked at, we compared males and females in terms of who experienced this frontal lobe's transcendence peak experience after learning how to click their amygdala forward. Well, it turns out the women have the experience twice as often as men. Women are much more successful as clicking their amygdala forward as men are, right? And so you have to kind of ask yourself, well, why is that? Well, it's because men go out and hunt. Women stay home and take care of the family, right? They stay together,
right.
But men pump themselves up and they go out and they go kill something and bring home the meat. So we're kind of genetic, males are genetically pre-programmed to click backward in the killer ape mentality, where women are genetically pre-programmed to click forward and to cooperate into the neighborhood family. You follow the difference?
Right.
So males have a little further to go in terms of clicking forward. So when you get, you know, especially when you're an outsider, and I was an outsider in terms of this forum, I was new to the forum, a new guy comes into the neighborhood, well, the first reaction of males is to kill the intruder. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting. And believe me, I've spent a lot of time during this past 10 years on the web. It should be no surprise to anyone how common that is, especially when the web is kind of like, you know, how people have road rage. For some reason,
yeah.
They feel safer. They feel like being in a car, being the sort of anonymous entity inside this vehicle where you don't know who's driving the car, somehow they feel like that's a safe and appropriate place to vent your frustration and anger. And the web is exactly the same thing. You know, you get on one of these forums and you're anonymous. The guy yesterday, he called himself, of all things, mystical, right? he was brutal, right? And he wouldn't have dared behave that way to somebody he was face to face with. But the internet and the web provides you with this kind of safe anonymity. And if you're frustrated or if you're angry, hey man, just go on a forum and let loose, you know? It's crazy.
I have a question about clicking forward your amygdala that has to do with neurotransmitters.
Yeah.
And because I've noticed that for me, I have a lot of these experiences when I'm actually moving, when I'm exercising or when I'm walking. When I'm moving, I'm exercising, hiking, walking, running, dancing. Movement seems to be associated with a lot of the experiences I've had of feeling connected to something bigger than myself or peak experiences.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you noticed that at all with people that have clicked forward their amygdala, how exercise or physical activity.
Absolutely. Well, there are two things I thought of, actually, when you said that. One, of course, was endorphins. When you do physical exercise, you release what's called enkephalins or endorphins, and these are the natural opiates produced in your body, which are kind of natural painkillers. But, you know, along with this pain-killing type of effect is the euphoria that comes along with it. That's what's called runner's high, okay? And so physical exercise, if you do it on a regular basis, will produce this euphoria, this kind of transcendence. And if you're feeling good, you tend to see the big picture, you know? If you're feeling pain, you withdraw and you pull in, okay? But if you're feeling good, if you're feeling these pleasurable neurotransmitters floating around in your blood, then you're going to have much more of a tendency to have one of those peak experiences. And what's interesting is that a lot of people don't understand that the reason that that drugs like cocaine and heroin and morphine and the synthetic opiates work, you know, like Percodan and Percocet and stuff like that, it's because your brain already has, when you're born, your brain has receptors for those chemicals. Your body already makes those chemicals as part of life when you need them or, you know, as necessary. And so when you take an external chemical, all it's doing is it's plugging into these receptors in your brain, you know, that are for those same chemicals that you can make yourself. Okay? So one of the ways you make them yourself is through physical exercise. Duh! Think about it. Your brain rewards you for activities that enhance your survival. Duh! It's a big duh. You feel good when you run because running is good for you. Isn't that? I mean, think about it. It's freaking amazing. Right? You don't make endorphins when you sit on your fat ass and watch TV all day, right? You know, now you do if you're watching a comedy show, right? But isn't that interesting that your brain rewards you through actual chemicals inside your brain when you do physical activity? It's blazingly amazing to me. Now, the other thing I thought of, also, you talked about when you're running and you go hiking. We are, like I said before, we're culturally conditioned to click backwards, right? So when you're in the city, you're surrounded by all of these cultural institutions that keep you click backwards. But when you go up into the mountains or you go into the woods, you've removed yourself from that competitive consciousness, and suddenly, hey, I feel good. Well, no wonder. It's not dog-eat-dog anymore. So it sounds like there are two levels by which that peak experience is happening. One, you're getting out of the competitive world, but two, you're also producing endorphins.
Make sense? Yeah, I'm really interested in the brain because I overcame depression by exercise and eating correctly and trying to produce the chemicals in my brain that would make me feel better. And I was just wondering if that is related to the frontal lobe, if that's a frontal lobe activity, or if it's connected to the frontal lobe, or if it's in the reptile, or what I call the rat brain, or if it's, you know, or is it all connected? Because sometimes part of the transcendent quality of physical fitness is that you feel as though all those layers of your brain are becoming connected.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense or not.
No, that makes perfect sense to me. Well, first of all, there's no pleasure in the reptile brain itself. It doesn't process any emotional content at all, okay? The pleasure receptors are in the midbrain. They're in the mammal brain, okay? What the frontal lobes do, and there's actually no pleasure in the frontal lobes directly, but what the frontal lobes allow you to do is to set up your environment and set up your situation so that you can be rewarded by the introduction and increased production of these pleasurable neurotransmitters. Does that make sense? In other words, you can't enjoy yourself when you're worried about survival. You have to do a certain amount of, there's many things that cause the release of these pleasurable chemicals in the brain. And what the frontal lobes allow you to do is to recreate those situations by which you can produce and release those chemicals. Typically, people who are worried about problems, about money, about relationships, if you're worried about basic survival, you're not going to experience those pleasurable feedback phenomenon. So you have to be able to solve your problems and arrange your life so that you can engage in those activities that release the chemical. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of?
Yeah. It does make sense. I think it makes sense to carry
on. If you've got chains on your legs, right, it's going to be much more, you know, if you haven't solved some basic problems, you're not going to be able to take the time off to go running, right? You're not going to be able to take a dance class if you're being harassed by the IRS, you know. Here's another example. Let's say you just get in an argument with somebody, right? In order to feel good, first you have to neutralize all the bad emotions that the fight created, right? And then you've got to go beyond that to feel good. So the frontal lobes, they just allow you to put yourself in those places by which you can produce the feel-good chemical.
Okay, gotcha. So, Diana, you had one more question before we end the show.
Actually, I just had a comment for Neil. I love your humor that's coming out in the book. And,
thank you.
You're welcome. And I'm really enjoying the book. I love the way you broke down the triona brain for everyone. And I also love the part where you wrote, intellect and creative problem solving uses less energy than lack of intelligence. Because I think that when people are out there living in the rat race and not focused on their and not consciously aware of what's going on around them, I think they do tend to burn up a lot more energy than those who are consciously aware and focusing on their day-to-day issues.
Yes, well, thank you. Well, that's a neurological fact. In fact, they've measured the amount of glucose being utilized in the brain, and when you are sort of banging your head against the wall and not able to do problem solving, you use up a lot of more glucose than when you are efficiently able to solve problems. I don't know if I've put that quite right. I think the car engine analogy is really the best. Let's say you have a four-cylinder engine, okay, and you're running on two cylinders. You only have two spark plug wires connected. You're going to get terrible gas mileage because the engine has to work really hard to move the vehicle on the two cylinders. But if you're running on all four cylinders, if you've got all four spark plug wires connected, you're going to get much better gas mileage, even though nothing else in the car has changed. You're just using the potential of the engine. So I think that's a really good point to keep in mind, that if you use the potential within your brain, you know, you're going to spend a lot more time coasting and it'll be just much easier to get from point A to point B. Just use that available, you know, potential that you've got.
Right.
And thank you for the compliment. It sounds like that you're enjoying the book, and I love it when
I truly am.
When I'm on the same wavelength as my readers.
Oh, this is definitely a wonderful experience for me reading this book.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, we love it, Diana and I.
Yes, definitely. Actually, Sydney's been trying to get me to read it for a long time,
I finally got to it. I'm working on a new book right now, and I'm hoping to get it done in the next few months. So look forward to that. I'm not going to give away the title because it's kind of top secret, but... it'll be...
Well, make sure you send me a copy so we can have you back on the show.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Definitely we'll do that.
That would be
definitely
wonderful.
Do that.
Awesome.
Yeah,
will the info go through your mailing list?
What?
You'll send info through your mailing list when you have
yeah,
a book.
Yeah, you know, anyone, if they don't know, if you're listening and you don't realize this, if you go to my website, brainraider.com, there's a Yahoo newsletter group. You just put in your email address, and I post news on that a couple times a week, and I'm actually explaining to people on the newsletter right now what my writing process is as I'm going through and writing the book, and what my experience is in terms of writing and so on. So it'll be announced on that, and you know, I'll contact everyone that I can once it's finished. I was shocked the other day. I've been self-published for 10 years, but I am published in Europe by one of the largest publishing companies there, Roald Verlag. And they've done a foreign language edition of my book. And I talked to my publisher there the other day, and I was shocked to find out that they had sold thousands of copies of my book. And just by mere virtue of it being in their catalog, and I guess people liked the title and the description, and they had sold out their second printing already of the book. So I guess somebody out there likes it.
That's wonderful.
Well, we want to thank you, Neil. We like it, and we enjoy it. And so everyone who is listening to us tonight or who's going to download this episode, do go to Brain Radar, www.brainradar.com, and check out the book. Buy the book. You can buy the book on the website.
No, I have a question. Now, before you go, this show is archived so people can listen to it later?
Yes.
Yes.
On the website? And where would I find that on your website?
I'll send it to you. I'll send you a link.
Oh, okay. And what I'll do, we've got our newsletter group has got like 12,000 people in it at this point. And so I'll make sure and send everyone that link. So they can listen to that show and at their leisure. And it sounds like you'll probably get some new members for your website and all that too.
Awesome, awesome. The show, the link will be ready, should be ready within an hour or so.
Oh, fantastic.
And I will send it directly to you.
All right.
Want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. We had an awesome time with you.
Yes, we'd love to have you back.
Sydney and Diane, is that your other person there?
Diana,
yeah.
Well, Diana, well, the time just flew for me as well.
So good night to you, Neil, and thank you for joining us. And I will be emailing you, and we are so looking forward to your new book.
Oh,
and everyone, do go check out brainradar.com. You're going to love it. You're going to love it.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night, Neil.
Good night, Neil. All right. Well, that is the end of our special episode, and we're going to roll up out of here and say good night to everyone. Good night, Matt, Diana, LaSalle, Karen, Merlin, Alyssa, Angela, Jim, Kim, ATV Rider, Following My Heart, Big Lead. I think that's Clark 704, Musician Man, Jim Knox, and South Kakalaki, South Carolina. I love saying South Kakalaki. I don't know why. But anyway, we want to thank you all for joining us tonight. And the people that are streaming who are not in the room, do join us again on Friday. We have a special guest called coming to visit us at 8 p.m., our scheduled episode program. And it's the Invisible Gardener, Andy, the Invisible Gardener. The topic is Don't Panic, It's Organic. He has a radio show on AM in California called Don't Panic, It's Organic. So we're going to talk to him about organically growing our gardens and stuff and flowers and veggies and all that good stuff. So if you're into gardening, even if you're not into gardening and you want to learn how to grow your own veggies or your own garden or have some delicious plants, do join us because it's all spiritual to us. I think so. Everything's spiritual. So come on, have fun. Join us on Friday, 8 p.m. And Diana, I'm going to cue the music.
All righty.
And thank you, girl, for joining me again.
Thank you. Wonderful show.
All right, I love you.
I love you, too.
Remember that you are source energy in a physical body. Remember who you are. Remember that you are magnificent. Remember that you can be, do, and have anything you desire. And remember, it's not being extraordinary that makes you unique. It's your uniqueness that makes you extraordinary. Have a great night. See you on Friday. Bye, Diana.
Bye, Sydney.
Love you.
Love you.